Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And Jim, before we get started, I think what I really wanted to do with the bad martini today was just a little too much inside baseball. But today is not only the last day of a month, it's the last day of a quarter, and I'm sure your inbox is even more flooded with fundraising emails from candidates than mine is, and I just had to vent somehow.
Oh, let it out, Greg. Make it talk. Two observations. One is, yes, we're getting them, and it's always, you know, first of all, apparently on the Obama campaign, they learned that the subject line that was most likely to get somebody to open the message was just, hey. No capital letters, no further information, just, hey. And out of sheer curiosity or something, that got people to open up emails and other people didn't. And I kind of have this, you know, every time I see it, I'm like, aha, they read the same books. They're all trying to do that. Look, if you're asking me for money, just come out with a message that says, look, we're nagging you for money. Yes, I know you're right up against the deadline. Yes, I know you're so close to your fundraising goal. Yes, I know Hillary Clinton has said something shocking and the only way we can really stand up to it is by giving you money, blah, 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 blah. The other thing is that someone who does not like me signed me up on some email list under the name, I am such an incredible moron. Pretty regularly, I get emails from, dear, I am such an incredible moron. The fundraising deadline is coming up, etc. So at least I know which groups are using the same list. So whoever that is who doesn't like me and thinks I'm such an incredible moron, they've done me a favor. So thanks for that.
Yeah, you're not going to be tempted to donate to those. Okay, on to the good martini now. And obviously, in the wake of two very disagreeable Supreme Court decisions late last week on Obamacare and marriage, there's been a lot of grumbling and a lot of frustration about what to do about it, and not only in terms of those specific policies, but what to do about the court and the proper role of the court. We've heard Scott Walker and I believe Ted Cruz call for constitutional amendments, once again returning the power to define marriage to the states. And Cruz probably got the most attention for saying he wanted another constitutional amendment to have periodic judicial retention elections. Jim, as a conservative who likes some of the conservatives on the court during the Obama era, I can see how this could be very problematic if there's a Democratic president and these justices don't get retained. I think there's a little bit of overreaction on the process and what the Constitution calls for here. But in terms of the role of the court, it's probably a discussion worth having.
Absolutely. And it's really, I'm still thinking through what I think of this Ted Cruz proposal. The gist is, you know, the Supreme Court justice gets nominated. On the second presidential election after they join the court, they would be up for a retention election. And I'm going to talk to his people, try to get more details on how exactly this would work. I guess the gist is it would be on that year's presidential election ballot, there'd be another one, you know, should Justice so-and-so remain on the court for another 8 years? And the country could vote yes, the country could vote no. If they said no, you're off the court and there's an opening. And even if it's not the ideal proposal to fix this, it does address certain, you know, concerns people are starting to have about the court. One being lifetime appointments, and we all remember Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg nodding off during the State of the Union address. On the one hand, it's hard to blame her. On the other hand, we've seen justices be on the court well into their 70s, 80s, and you know, wondering if just physiologically, you know, whether they're in the right kind of health to handle this kind of really important duty. Also, for obvious reasons, conservatives believe that justices appointed by Republicans tend to drift left over time. Whereas if you look at David Souter, is probably the biggest example of this, but I think certain people are asking this about Roberts, and I think people have kind of observed that Kennedy is by no stretch down the line a consistent, strict constructionist type. And so, you know, nobody ever has these questions about Ginsburg or any of the Clinton or Obama appointees. And so there's this attitude where, look, if a Republican president's about half their justices are going to turn out the way they hope, for Democrat justices, they're ideologues. They always vote the way the left wants them to. And unsurprisingly, people feel like the court is shifting left. Now, some people have said if you look at the entirety of their cases, there have actually been some improvements in terms of putting limitations on government power. But there's a reason conservatives are up in arms about the Supreme Court right now. And it does seem like maybe not the best system to have people up there for lifetime appointments. Maybe it's fair to bring on a justice and start reviewing their decisions and say, wait a minute, did you make sense of this? And I realize on the one hand that the founders wanted a judiciary to be independent and free of the passions of the public and not have to be up for re-election all the time. On the flip side, as my colleague Andy McCarthy has said, and you're hearing more conservatives say it now, look, who are we kidding? The judiciary is not independent. The Supreme Court has a bunch of political operators on it. And right now, I think you and I would pretty easily agree there are four political operators. And then you have five guys who are looking at the Constitution. And some days they agree with us and some days they don't. If justices are going to start treating their jobs as politicians, then they ought to be accountable like politicians. As much as you may not love this idea, I think you're going to see a more serious discussion of the Supreme Court on the presidential campaign trail this year. And I think it's a good thing because for a long time, Republican candidates would say, look, you may not like Romney or you may not like McCain, but wouldn't you feel better with them making Supreme Court appointments than Barack Obama? Well, after this week, I'm not so sure that's an applause line on the campaign trail anymore. I'm not sure conservatives are all that convinced that Republican Supreme Court nominees are that much better than Democrat ones.
Well, some of them certainly would be the case, and maybe it would be. As long as everything is getting more political, to have candidates specifically say who they'd nominate, and then people could tell well ahead of time whether they'd be a squish or whether they'd be a rock solid conservative, like Scalia and Thomas have been, and Alito seems to be at this point. As far as the others, obviously you've got the accusation that there's no way of separating politics from the court, and that could be bad for the long term. I guess going back to our opening point, you would have to get ready for. I'm John Roberts, and I approve this message.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of details to be thought out about this. But, boy, it'd be kind of fascinating to see those kinds of elections, and I wouldn't. And by the way, keep in mind, there are state Supreme Court elections in places like Pennsylvania. There are quite a few places where at the state level you do elect judges.
Yes.
And we can argue how well it works in those states, but it's not like it's completely without precedent. So.
Yeah, certainly the case. I grew up in Michigan, and they certainly do it there. All right, on to the bad martini now, Jim. And one of the things that has frustrated you greatly and to the great entertainment of your readers over the years is how Chelsea Clinton has somehow been vaulted into this global icon of young women and just a woman of tremendous accomplishment. And you think it's hard to find an accomplishment from her mother's resume. Well, she certainly takes the cake in this area as well. But here's the story that's got a lot of people grinding today from the Washington Post. When the University of Missouri at Kansas City was looking for a celebrity speaker to headline its gala luncheon marking the opening of a Women's Hall of Fame, one name came to mind, Hillary Rodham Clinton. But when the former Secretary of State's representatives quoted a fee of $275,000, officials at the public university balked. So the school turned to the next best option, her daughter Chelsea. The university paid $65,000 for Chelsea Clinton's brief appearance February 24th, 2014. More than 500 pages of emails, contracts, and other internal documents obtained by the Post from the university under Missouri public record laws detail the school's long courtship of the Clintons. They show the meticulous efforts by Chelsea Clinton's image makers to exert tight control over the visit, ranging from close editing of marketing materials and the introductory remarks of a high school student to limits on the amount of time she spent on campus. She spoke for 10 minutes, was on a panel for 20 minutes, and spent a half an hour posing for pictures for $65,000. But of course, Jim, she didn't take the money. She had it directed to the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation.
Yes, which, by the way, pays for all the transportation costs and many of the expenses and the lifestyle of the Clintons. But she totally didn't take any money, right? Oh, by the way, it also means she doesn't have to pay taxes on it. Yeah, you summarized my perpetual state of incredulity, Greg. And I'd point out that one of the reasons I feel this way is going back to the 1990s when Chelsea Clinton was being raised in the White House, there were folks on the right who said not nice things about her. They made fun of her appearance and things like that. That's a jerky thing to do. And for a long time, there was this attitude of leave Chelsea alone. Like, she didn't pick her parents. She came into this world. She deserved to try to have as normal a childhood and young adulthood as she possibly could. And I very firmly believed in that. For a while, Chelsea Clinton was kind of out of the public spotlight. And I'd be perfectly happy to let Chelsea Clinton live a happy life away from the spotlight all she wants. Except she didn't want that. She wanted a life in the spotlight. And, probably the most glaring example of this was the spectacular run on NBC News on the Brian Williams program, Rock Center. Although in retrospect, now that we know what we know about Brian Williams, maybe it's a better fit than we thought, isn't it, Greg? You keep seeing her on magazine covers and, Fast Company did this giant glowing profile when she took over the Clinton Foundation. I mean, oh, what are the odds? What are the odds she'd get hired to run her parents' foundation? Boy, who'd she have to know to get that job? And I just kind of feel like she's this poster girl for nepotism. There's nothing she's done in life without her father and her mother and father's name and her parents' enormous wealth and enormous power and the perception that her mother very well could be the next president of the United States. The only thing we've seen in the public of her performance was NBC News, and she was terrible at the job. The Baltimore Sun ripped her every single appearance and said, this is really shoddy work. And she was making, I want to say, something like $300,000, $600,000, some unbelievable six-figure sum to do that shoddy work. And it looked very much like NBC News was just trying to buy access to the Clinton family. When you look at the University of Missouri at Kansas City with this, you know, like you run the numbers on this speech, Greg, it is $1,083 each minute of her appearance. And you wonder why tuition is so high. I'm just baffled by the fact that everybody around the Clintons seems to think this is a perfectly good way to spend money. And everybody at the university thinks they totally got their money's worth from Chelsea Clinton on this. Even though it looks like they probably lost something in the neighborhood of like $30,000 in that appearance. I'm baffled. So it's a bad martini. It's good that the Washington Post is spotlighting this. But it seems like this has been going on for quite some time. And America at large has kind of decided we're just kind of okay with it. And I will stand athwart history, Greg, saying, no, I will not treat Chelsea Clinton as if she's some extraordinary woman and role model for all of us to try to emulate.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people in the media still, I don't think they still think of her as being 13 or 14, but they've carried that same mentality forward that she's off limits somehow because of the fact that she came up when she was a minor. And at that point, she should have been off limits. But her actions since then certainly have not drawn the scrutiny that others would have. And just for the record, it would appear that Jenna Bush is the better NBC correspondent than
Well, I mean, she stayed in the job, right? This was not a lark for her, you know, so.
Exactly. All right, on to the crazy martini now. And I believe as of this moment that we're recording, Jim, there are 13 official Republican presidential candidates. We're going to get a 14th today, and that is New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. About 18 months ago, when he dominated his reelection bid in a very blue state of New Jersey, it looked like he was cruising to a very prominent role in the Republican presidential primary this year. He said all the right things in his victory speech, but then after that, you had Bridgegate, which has largely cleared him, his aides not so much, at least a couple of them. But he took a hit for that. His approval rating in New Jersey is now hovering around 40%. He's taking on water in a lot of different areas. He's not getting a lot of attention in this campaign so far, but he is a blunt guy. He was able to win as a Republican in blue states. He took on the unions and won on major issues like education and to some extent budgeting in the state of New Jersey. So he definitely brings an interesting resume to the field. It just feels like he's getting in because he always planned to, even though the tea leaves don't look good for him at all anymore.
Yeah, I think it says something that I can, you know, go around and give a lot of speeches and discussions and you know, things like that about the upcoming 2016 presidential race. And I'm trying to remember where if we mentioned Christie, it was in passing. People are not asking about him. And look, some of this may be very unfair. It may be that he is unfairly tarnished by a Bridgegate investigation that certainly implied he was directly connected, and yet no evidence has come to pass on that. On the other hand, the sympathetic reading of that sequence of events is not that, you know, Christie knew about it, but just that he hired terrible people who do terrible things, which is not the, you know, the most roaring endorsement for Christie. We can wish him luck, but it's kind of hard to see where he fits in this field right now, because the idea is at one point, well, okay, he'll be the establishment choice. And certainly it looks like Jeb Bush has made a strong case for that. He certainly has made a same effort to target the same Wall Street, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut fundraising base. If you want to say, well, somebody, the field needs somebody who's not a conservative, somebody to be the voice of moderates, somebody to be the voice of not down-the-line conservative Republican, I think John Kasich is trying to position himself as that. I saw, you know, somebody was joking around replacing a picture of John Huntsman every time they needed a picture of John Kasich. It's just kind of, you know, it's a crowded field. And for somebody, some of these guys, it's a little harder to see where they fit. Now, look, Christie, if there's a couple of things Christie will have going for him. One is, you know, he won twice in a blue state. There was a point where the Republican Party was much more enthused about him. I think the real problem with Christie is just how often he has ended up defining himself in opposition to the rest of the party, right, and basically said, well, look, I'm not like those Republicans. You know, those Republicans in Washington who are messing around with Sandy relief. Now, obviously, one of the things they were doing was trying to get rid of the pork. So when you become the Republican and criticizing other Republicans for doing something conservative, you're going to have some big problems when you run for the Republican nomination for president. And so we'll see how it shakes out. Again, it looks like whatever window there was for Christie, it may have closed. He'll also have this, you know, no pun intended, larger-than-life personality, which might do him very well on a debate stage, particularly if everybody's getting limited time. But again, much tougher path to the nomination than we may have envisioned, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago.
I think we got to put Christie and Trump in the NCAA bracket for outsized personalities and let them play it out in the first round. What do you think?
Ooh, there we go. I'd kind of like to see Christie shout down Trump. That could be kind of – just turn down the volume on your set before that one.
That'll be number 14. I think we still got Kasich and Walker at least to go. So we're going to have the Sweet 16. This bracket is shaping up perfectly.
Yeah, it is going to be 16. Now watch somebody jump out of nowhere. Who's the Pat Paulson of our day, Greg?
That's a good question. Play-in game.
There you go. All right. So here's the good news. Whatever you are as a Republican, there's somebody out there who speaks for you. They may be at 1% of the poll, but they're there.
You can't complain about lack of options this time, that's for sure. Jim, well, we'll see what Christie has to say today, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.